This podcast is in no way affiliated with the Stars production or Diana Gabaldone. All views expressed are solely our own. Welcome to the Outlander podcast,
where the men are kilted, the women are winsome,
and the whiskey is neat.
Welcome to episode 374 of the Outlander podcast. I'm Ginger.
And I'm Summer, and we are in love with all things Outlander.
This episode, we'd like to thank co-producer Raquel M. And there are still some spots left on our Podbra 2021 trip. If you'd like to find out more, you can go to podabra.com. And finally, we'd love to hear from you. Join our text community at 916-659-5112. This episode is sponsored by Ana Luisa.
And now, on to our read-along. We are continuing our A Breath of Snow and Ashes read-along with chapter 54 entitled Flora McDonald's Barbecue. And I would like to start this segment of our show off by saying I don't think this is going to be in the show.
Yeah.
I think it's just out of time, too much.
Because
they moved too many of the moving parts.
Oh, I mean, forward or back, whatever,
yeah,
into season
into
five?
Into season five.
Like, well, I don't necessarily disagree. I think, let's put it this way. And this is, I'm not trying to be harsh. I know people think I am. I'm not trying to be harsh. I'm trying to be a little more realistic. Would it be nice? Sure. Is it required? No. So that's part of it, right? It's not required. However, let's say we wanted it. Okay, how would it work? Well, the idea of having this gathering, because it is, right? It's a type of gathering, right? They have the actual gathering, which was, I guess, in book five. Did they not do the gathering?
They did, but it was at the Ridge. But it wasn't really the gathering. Remember? But it was like the gathering, but it was also the wedding. It was the first episode.
I know that. Well, obviously, I'm stumbling over my words. So what I'm about to say could cause a laugh, which is fine. Yeah. I know the story so well. Ha, ha, ha.
You think that they did things they didn't do?
Well, no. I mean the book, only the book. I know, or I'm so familiar with the book, and I've seen and watched the show so much that I absolutely have choreographed scenes, like those scenes. And like when I read, I don't see Katrina. But when we talk about it, and I'm like, oh yeah, in the scene where blankety blank, I absolutely see Katrina. So in my mind, we had that scene, and we didn't.
They didn't do her at all.
Okay, I can't speak to any of that. That's right, we had Ophedra, so whatever.
Well, we didn't have that, and we also didn't have the laundress, remember? Remember the when I was the Dumbs of Autumn?
Dumbs of Autumn. Yeah, the Dumbs of Autumn. Yeah, there's a lot of stuff they didn't do. Okay, so back to this story. Yes, so while it would be nice, it's always nice to have a big thing, I think because they brought so much, technically they brought it forward, even though they went back in time, right? They knocked back in time. The stuff that happens later, they brought back, which means it's in season five, however you want to look at that. I think enough stuff was brought into season five that, yeah, if and even without that stuff in season six to have to be covered, there is so much left, should they choose to tackle it, that they would probably benefit from not doing the
barbecue. Lots of moving parts to this.
Well, and the barbecue, whenever you have a huge thing, a gathering, a barbecue, a wedding or whatever, to make it good, to make it worthy of doing it, I'm not even talking about filming, although that's part of it. It almost takes up an entire episode.
It would be an entire episode.
That's what I mean. And that's a lot of time to give up.
And it would be an entire, okay. I think that they are going to, if they do leave it in, it will be solely just to have Flora McDonald.
Yeah, that, exactly.
That's the only reason they'd keep it. Because there's so many other side parts of this story that happen in this chapter that either already happened or we made changes last season in a way that they wouldn't be sustainable in this season.
They're not needed, yeah.
So I think that they could absolutely keep Flora McDonald in the series. And I think that there, but I don't think that it will be under the same circumstances at all as it is in the book if they do keep her.
Yeah. And if they wanted to keep her for some reason, they could find a way, maybe not just like in season four, but just like in season four when they had people go to the theater and Claire did that surgery in the theater. Mm-hmm. And we meet George freaking Washington. Come on. If you can throw a Washington in the middle of a theater, you can throw a floral. You can throw a floral. Floral. You can throw Flora McDonald into something. Into something.
Yeah.
If you really want to get her there without having to spend an entire episode on it. Yeah. So any hoozle. Yeah, we are back at the River Run. Dang, the River Run in the books is like it gets a lot of movement. River Run Plantation, August 6, 1774. It's a Leo barbecue. Mm-hmm. We get another date. So Farquhar Campbell is married. Her name is Rachel, by the way. So if I'm not mistaken, I just pointed that out because I thought it was cute. He was one of the ones who was asking Bree to marry him, right?
I believe
when she was pregnant and all that?
Everyone was. They all wanted River Run.
So while it's not the point of this chapter to take us back to the time of Culloden, it really is a bit like Steggy back.
Wow. Hey,
I think I see how this is going to go. It really is a bit like stepping back in time. Ha. For the story. The main reason for this woman's historical significance is how she helped, maybe only significance, is how she helped the Bonnie Prince. So we get a little bit of, and this is unneeded, but it's cute. So we get a little bit of backstory. Jamie had actually seen her once, technically, I guess not formally introduced, but met her, seen her once on the Isle of Skye, where she was from, when his dad had brought him along with him on a matter of sheep to deal with her stepfather. And I wrote they were about six. I think she was about six. Jamie might be slightly older. I think later on is clarified, but I didn't go back and correct myself. So at least she was six. So while the prince at this time, now we're back in the time of the barbecue, 1774. Did I read that correct? 1774. While the prince was likely still alive in Italy somewhere, right? Physically alive. For all intents and purposes, he was dead. Like he may as well be gone. He has no effect on their lives. Everything that he did that affected them was done during or after the time of Culloden.
Could you imagine? Obviously this didn't happen. No, obviously this didn't happen, but could you just imagine if Bonnie Prince showed up in America and was like, let's do it again.
Oh my
goodness. One more time for Scotland.
one last time. Yeah, no. I wouldn't say his platform was tenuous during the days of Culloden, but the rising of the 45, but he has no footing at all in the colonies. There's nothing there. And he lost for once and for all. Like that's done. Once and for all. Sorry, not for once and for all. I'm totally changing all the wording of everything here. So during this, or in this chapter, around this time, Claire has a flashback to her encounter with Louis. And this is her first flashback to that event, when she, with consent, I mean, yes, it was under duress, but it was consented, you know, as gnarly as that may have been, it was consented, quid pro quo. Although you could actually make a great argument that if you are being pressured.
Yeah, I mean, it was coerced. I mean,
I'll put it this way. She went to him. Yeah, she was she not knew coerced it was gonna to happen. Going to him. Yes.
She hoped it wouldn't.
Yeah.
But she knew it was going to happen. You know what I mean? That was, they warned her. They were like, he's going to expect, you know, well, he doesn't expect.
That's the one thing he
doesn't expect her to have.
No, not to have one, to get it.
He gives.
My point is, it involves D. He expects the D.
He expects to give the D. He's not expecting D. When you say, okay, if I said I expect D, that means I'm expecting someone to give me the D. So if you said he expects D, he's not expecting D. He's expecting to give the D.
He's expecting to use his D.
Good God.
So the point is.
Conversations you make me have.
I know, right? They're enlightening and they are.
Are they though?
To me anyway. So she has a flashback to her encounter with Louis. The first time ever. Now in her mind, she'd definitely traveled to another place in time. time, place, of course, they're still 18th century. France, time of at the court during the just before the rising, right? Mm-hmm. Now this she tells Jamie, this freaks Jamie out. Or excuse me, Jamie doesn't know right away what's going on. He just knows that she's left her body, not literally, but you know, she's spaced out a little bit. And this freaks Jamie out, and he's worried that she was going to faint. She had staggered back against the wall of Hector Cameron's mausoleum, another thing we never get to see in the show. She is stuck in the memory for a little bit, but she finally comes out all the way. Now, to others who are watching this, she blames the hot day, because if it's hot, it's going to be likely, if it's hot, it's muggy. So there's a lot that she can like blame it on. Jamie brings out some whiskey for her from his sporran. So she's having a little, and I will refer to it later because I believe I took notes on it later as it comes up later in the chapter again to refer to this. But yes, it's a flashback, but I'm not saying it's more than that, but more comes of it. Meaning I believe there's more connection to her PTSD, right? This is her PTSD making connections with the experience she had, making connections with other similar things. Even if we all agreed, which we're probably not going to, even if we all agreed that it was completely consensual, it was still an act of penetration, right? And so I could totally see where she felt she had to do something, which knocks down the whole consent thing a little bit. But anyway, even if it was completely different circumstances as far as what was going on around her, but she was still on her back with someone on top of her. So I could see at the very basic level how her PTSD related to her abduction and rape could absolutely trigger something like this. So, and also a little more evidence, because Diana tells us it's the first time she's ever had a flashback about her encounter with Louis. Now, does it mean she never would have had one ever, ever, ever? She hadn't been abducted and raped? No, of course not. We don't know that. And
I would have had a flashback literally every time I went to a museum that had any kind of anything from
from court of France
period. Yes. I'd be like, but it's, yeah, I totally had.
What I'm saying, it's interesting, Summer. What I'm saying is, it's interesting that Diana goes out of her way to tell us it's been what 20 plus years now. Well, no, gosh, 30 years now. So okay, 1774, Ginger, we have a date. That was in 1744, five, probably four. So that's 40 to 70. That's 30. A little more than 30 years. If Diana is telling us she's never had a flashback about her encounter with Louis, it probably didn't affect her that much. Yeah, she didn't like it. Maybe she blocked it out, but it never came back to bug her in a way. That's what Diana tells us.
I need to Google what museums have portraits of Louis the 14th.
So you can go to them?
No, because if there was one anywhere near Boston, you know she took Brie.
Oh,
and
gosh.
You know she walked through that museum and was like, I can't go in that. I can't.
That's interesting. Okay, that's interesting. Well, hold on. It's not just what museums had any portrait. It's what museums in the 50s and 60s had portraits. So what you may find now may not be reflective of what happened back then. Anyway, yes. Yeah, so the reason I say this, and I'm kind of pausing here to make a point, is that she had an encounter that she wasn't happy to have. Yes, she liked the result. She liked getting Jamie out of the Bastille, but she would rather have not had to do that, obviously. But it wasn't, I want to say treacherous, it wasn't impactful enough to plague her for 30 years. That's all I'm trying to say. So maybe she blocked it out. Who knows? But now that a few months ago, I didn't go back and see how long it had been since she had been abducted and raped, but probably a few months at least. It's still fresh. So now that she has that fresh tragedy, that fresh trauma or trigger that led to trauma, or event that led to trauma, excuse me. And after she flipped out on Uta, we know she gets stuck in these, and she is having active PTSD bouts or events. I'm not sure what the clinical term for those is, or experiences. The fact that she flashed back to Louis, and she's from the outside, someone watching her, she goes pale, she's sweating, and Jamie's afraid she's going to faint. Yeah, that's new. That's new as far as Louis is concerned. That's new.
According to the Museum of Fine Arts Boston, they have a there's a portrait of him as it looks like a young man.
And then how long has that been here? Been there.
It says provenance 1937, Gallery Paul Kelly, Paris, sold by Kelly to Forsyth Wicks to New York, Newport, Rhode Island, and Boston. It's 65. It was there in 65.
So if she went around that time, it's possible.
I'm just saying. Museum of Fine Arts Boston, they have pictures of him. It would have made Museum Day a little awkward.
So while this flashback had been of her time in France and with Louis, she notes that it was the second one, meaning a flashback or this type of event, that she'd had recently. The other, as I said, was the feral feeling that she got when Uta McGillivray attacked her. She had attacked back. So she communicates to Jamie in a few words, asking if he experiences anything similar. Of course, regarding flashbacks and his experiences in the past. She wonders if he's struggling with BJR in dreams or has in the past. And he says yes. But he says also sometimes when he's awake. So he fetches some salt and tells her to use a pinch of it when she feels this way to kind of, you know, to scare away the ghosts. Interesting words. Quote, if Louis was still alive, the other man, whoever he had been, that pressing weight in the dark was surely dead, unquote. So I don't want to spend too much time on that because there's a lot more chapter to go. But number one, okay, so her saying, I just happened to look it up and we know he was dead. It may not have been around, I didn't look at the date. Well, I guess we can do it. So at the time of this recording, he's certainly dead. At the time of the barbecue, he is dead. However, that is not known to them. She does not keep tabs on the royal family of France. What she says in the chapter is not know. She's like, I don't know if he's still alive. But she's saying if he was still alive, the other man, whoever he had been, that pressing weight in the dark, was surely dead. Now, I'm not sure I understand that, the whole guy in the dark being dead thing, because the guy in the dark had just happened and Louis happened 30 years ago.
Everyone who recently raped her is dead.
That is what the reader, that is correct. That is what we are led to believe, because no one was left at the site alive. That's all we know, right?
Correct.
So I guess there's not too much more we can say about this because that's all we got. So Flora, we meet Flora. Flora is smaller than Claire thought she'd be. And the whole family is there.
Isn't that the way of everyone, though?
Yes, all actors, everything. Well, actors are...
Well, just anyone that you've created mystique and myth around, you see them in real life and you're like, I thought they'd be taller. Or I thought they would be more. Not always, not necessarily smaller, but they usually end up, we've built them into these larger than life characters. And then the reality of them is always a little less, usually.
Yeah.
In some way.
So the whole family is there. It's Jamie and Claire and Bree. Well, okay, not Roger. Roger, at this point, was spending a month at the Presbyterian Academy at Charlotte to qualify for his ordination.
I'm sure there were lots of unwed mothers there.
Oh, Lord. Claire knows that while the McDonald's may be here now in the colonies, that because she knows from her history, from living in the future, being from the future, that Flora McDonald didn't die in the colony. She died in Scotland. So she knew that while she may be there now, Flora McDonald would not be staying in the colonies for long. She'd be going back to Scotland.
But she was very specific about it. She was like, she was disillusioned with America.
Yeah.
I wonder, do we think it is because she saw the revolution coming and was like, I want nothing to do with this. I'm going to go back there where at least I know what's going to happen.
I think we may be able to find out the answer, not right now, but I think I'm sure there are books written that have that information.
Probably.
Or historians have that. So an interesting moment I didn't remember from past reads or listens. When Claire meets Flora, what do we think she saw on her face? Quote, she looked up, expectant, met my gaze dead on, and blinked, her smile momentarily fading. It was back in an instant, and she was bowing to me and I to her, but I did wonder what she had seen on my face. Unquote. So, yeah, I mean, I got nothing. What do you guys think? And Summer, what do you think?
Say it one more time.
Okay. So Claire, Fiona. I'm going to freaking say Fiona now. Flora meets Claire. Or Claire meets Flora. And this is something that Claire wonders. Diana writes, quote, she being Flora, quote, she looked up expectant, met my gaze dead on, and blinked, her smile momentarily fading. It was back in an instant, and she was bowing to me and I to her, but I did wonder what she had seen on my face.
I wonder as well.
Me too. Then after she's made the rounds, Claire's able to meet her properly. Flora's all, Mrs. Fraser, I'm so much obliged to meet you at last. I've heard such stories of your kindness and skill. I confess I am in awe to be in your presence. Unquote. Ha. So how's this? How is this possible, right? How did she know so much and why is she in awe? All that stuff. So apparently she had met and known Dr. Fentiman and young Ian too. And we learned that Flora's proper name is, I'm probably going to butcher it, Fionnachal, which means fair one. If I butchered it, I apologize. Flora had brought along a mirror with her that the prince had given her. And they had set up the mirror in one of Jocasta's rooms, her dining room, not dining room, her sitting room or something, some room, where people were lining up to go in and look into it. Now, Jocasta calls to Jamie, and he goes to assist her since Ulysses and Duncan are busy. Major MacDonald is there. And so Claire is left alone. That's the point. Jamie's called away and it's just Claire by herself. Major MacDonald is there. And even Major MacDonald knew Flora. He actually, this makes sense. He had accompanied her from Wilmington to the barbecue and helped them get settled. And he reports that she will speak and Flora's going to give a little speech. And he asks Claire, where do you think the best place for this might be? Now, Claire doesn't have any real answers, so she excuses herself. And food was being brought out. Claire stays back from the food hordes because she wants to see if she might have an opportunity to inquire about Manfred. She targets those from Hillsborough, but no one she talks to had seen him, though they did know of him. Now, as she walks around, she hears talk of, quote, fiery articles. She wanders around, nibbling on different pieces of food for about an hour and then grabs a drink. And it's gross, so she wants to pour it out, but she runs into Neil Forbes, our favorite. Now, he was surprised to see her and had obviously been secretly meeting with Robert Howe and Cornelius Harnett behind a bush. So Claire had seen them behind the bush. Forbes has heard that Jamie is collecting guns. So what does this mean? Someone squealed. But you know, when Jamie has to put the word out, and he, I don't know if they say it here or it's in a previous chapter, but Jamie basically says, yeah, there's a chance that something like that could happen because, you know, once I couldn't get him from Manfred and his father, like, holy, I had to put the word out. And once the word goes out, like, we can't keep it a secret anymore. Someone's going to talk somewhere, but I still need to get these guns. So, you know, what happens, happens. So Forbes warns her about this. He says, Jamie needs to shut that ish down. And he says, he desires justice. This is Forbes. Forbes desires justice and the downfall of tyranny. Forbes goes off and gets into a heated discussion with some more people. And only Jocasta's dinner gong saves him. I'm guessing that saves him from getting into a fight. I did not finish that sentence. So come on, Ginger. Then it was time for Flora's speech. She thanks the Scottish community for welcoming her and exhorts, quote, against what she called factionalism, urging her hearers to join in suppressing this dangerous movement, which could not but cause great unrest, threatening the peace and prosperity that so many of them had achieved in this fair land, unquote. Summer, that might be an answer. So she is definitely, as were many of the Scots, right? She is definitely a loyalist, as are many of the Scots. So here she is in her speech exhorting against factionalism. Factionalism is a situation in which a group forms within a larger group, especially one with slightly different ideas from the main group. So it's something that she sees as potentially, and she was right, tearing a country, or this wasn't a country yet, or tearing a group apart. In this case, tearing a future country apart. And it did, right? It was the factionalism that led to, ultimately, I guess, led to the war. Mm-hmm. So she sees this infighting. Oh, I just described what Neil Forbes was fighting about. Neil Forbes is a patriot, or will be a patriot. He's I can't call him a dissenter. He's definitely not a loyalist, put it that way. It doesn't seem right, because he's against tyranny. And if you're against tyranny, you're not a loyalist. Or at least those are kind of words that you wouldn't see together. A loyalist would not be preaching against tyranny, put it that way, at this time. So that's her speech. And Claire's thinking about what Roger and Bree had argued about. Roger had argued that the Scots had something to lose. Okay, this is in the coming war. The Scots had something to lose and damn little to gain. And of all people, they knew exactly what it was like to fight against the English.
Mm-hmm.
Those who'd survived weren't likely to want to live through that again. And then Bree's argument was, but surely they'll want to fight for freedom. And Roger says, they have freedom more than they've ever seen in Scotland. So in that little paragraph, those little lines that I just read, right, that sums up a lot, or I think pretty well, the point of view, or the side, however you want to call it, of the Scots, of the Highlanders, no matter how they got there, whether they were forced to travel or whether they emigrated on their own to the American colonies. But that explains a lot, I think pretty well, of why so many Scots, remained loyalists.
I mean, it was still fresh. Everything was still so fresh. You know what I mean? It was not a future generation whose fathers told them that these terrible things happened under, you know, when they tried to fight against it. It was them. It was the people who had tried to fight against it and were then transported to a new place. So they were there in America, most of them, because they were sent to America. So they're here at the, you know, at the behest and direction of the British government already. So, you know, anything they have in America is directly related to having lost, and everything they have is given to them by them. You know what I mean?
Yeah. So as I predicted, I mean, I wrote this down, so I knew this, but I had forgotten. It's been a little while since I took the notes. Neil Forbes was one of those who disapproved of Flora's speech. Claire sees Bree looking at Neil, and he's looking back. He's still butthurt about her rejection of his suit a few years ago, before. And then there is celebratory firing of pistols by people in the crowd, led by Major MacDonald, after Flora's speech. So MacDonald, we know, is loyalist, right? Flora's a loyalist. Forbes is not. Jamie's going to, and there's a conversation all throughout. I mean, it may have even been a little bit in the last book, but definitely all throughout this book, or up until it happens, there's the threading of that conversation. Every few chapters, or every 10 chapters or so, the question comes up, like, is it time? Is it almost time? It's time. Is it almost time? And it's getting closer. And now you can see that it's no longer bubbling underneath. Like, the bubbles of this boil have escaped the cauldron. Like, they're already popping out. It is close, darn close. Or it's here, I should say. The sides are here. It's just, you have to speak your truth. And he hasn't quite done that yet, but
he'll have to attempt at a visual kind of a metaphor. Really
failed.
Well, it didn't fail. I was just very confused because, you know, because you said a boil, which to me, a boil is like, you know.
On a butt.
Like a
blister.
Like a blister with sickness. I was thinking of water. Of and then you said a boil from a cauldron. And I was like, why is there a boil in a cauldron? And I was boil, like, I think she boiling. Means something is boiling.
Yes.
In your cauldron, as opposed to a boil.
However,
being no, in your cauldron.
No, you've seen recipes say bring it to a boil. Yes, a boil in a cauldron. It's a thing. So Claire finds Jamie in the shade of the mausoleum on a self-made timeout. He's reflecting. Now he's reflected, like this whole thing, like I just said, this whole thing about both sides, the loyalists having fought. And Jamie's one of those, right? Jamie definitely, more than anyone, or at least archetype characters, well, archetype, more than any type of character, you have those who are solely and wholly in the past, or are people of the past, right? So that would be loyalists. And they want a better future, or they want to keep what they have now into the future. But they're loyal with, they're not forward thinking as in different type of government. They're like, let's keep it safe and not get killed. And then Jamie's actually of it, meaning he's of the time. And he went through the same experiences that many of the loyalists did, Scottish Highlanders. And then there's Bree and Claire and Roger who, yeah, okay, yeah, of course, they're from the future. So that's a huge difference, right? But they know, like, they know what the future holds.
Just a little different.
Just a tiny bit. They know what the future holds. And of course, whether or not Jamie wants to, like, objectively fight on whatever side. I don't think Jamie wants to fight, period. He's like, can we just go to the mountains and live? But whether or not Jamie believes in one side or the other, he knows from now three people, not just his main squeeze, he knows that he has to fight. Well, he doesn't have to fight. He knows that if he chooses the wrong side, there could be even worse consequences. Or you could die on any side. That's a given. But he knows that the future lies in patriotism. The future lies in this way.
As evidenced by Culloden, he knows what happens. When Claire says a thing happens, it happens.
Yeah, and now you have not just Claire, you have two other people. So now it's grown, meaning the number of people. And it's not that he doesn't, now, I'm not going back. It's not that he doesn't believe her or believe Bree or believe Roger.
He doesn't want it to be true. I mean, I would want nothing more.
Oh, no. 100%. He doesn't want it to be true. I don't know. Like, just the little thing that I read about what Bree said and what Roger said, coming from the past, which I know we don't have a fair judgment from because we can't. We're from the future and we have the history of a war won behind us and a government built behind us. But if I were of that time, I honestly don't know how much of an idealist I'd be. It would depend on if my history was Scottish. If myself or my parents had been sent from Scotland, I'd probably be a loyalist, Summer. Because how scary is that?
If you don't know what you don't know, you know what I mean?
People back there didn't know. I'm saying if we were back there and ourselves or our parents had been shipped over from Scotland, I don't have a fair view of this. It's very easy to say, oh, I'd be on the side of the cause for liberty. Really? I mean, I think it depends on anyone can change their mind. I'm not saying that everyone follows the lead of the one in front of them, but you are heavily influenced by your family and those around you and your circumstances and, you know, not just like what kind of house you have or how much money you have or that kind of thing, but the circumstances of those around you and the type of place you live in. And if I or my parents had been sent over from Scotland in the clearances or after Culloden, what have you, and I had those experiences or my parents like preached against them, or maybe they didn't even talk about them because they were bad, but I just knew it was bad. And they like, you know, busted my lip if I ever would like hint at anything about, you know, freedom and patriotism or whatever. Like that probably wouldn't even, my guess is that wouldn't even necessarily have been part of my vocabulary. So some of the founding fathers had Scottish ancestry. So me saying that if you were Scottish would mean that you were not one way or the other. Not at all. That's not what I'm saying. I'm saying looking at this barbecue, looking at the people who were so close to what had happened 30 years ago, I think that's, I don't say special as in they're more important than others. No, but I think it's a special type. It's a special population. I don't know that those of our founding fathers who did have Scottish ancestry necessarily had come over in the last, or families had come over in the last 30 years. I don't know. There could be, and I could be completely wrong, but I don't think I'm wrong. And the reason I don't think I'm wrong is because I'm not saying an absolute. All I can judge or read is what Diana's written. And from what Diana's written in what Bree said and Roger said, and then about Flora and about the people there, and then Neil Forbes. See, I don't know enough about Neil Forbes' background, meaning I don't know if he's only been, and he's a lawyer, so he's got more money, he's got more stability, and he's not reliant on the loyalist government, you know what I mean, or the British as much. So anyway, it's a lot of it has to do with, you know, what are you reliant on, and what have your experiences been? So we know Neil himself did not fight at Culloden, and he himself was not cleared out. I don't believe his mother may have been among those, but I have a feeling his mother was, you know, slightly higher, not higher class, but, you know, more well off than a lot of the Highlanders. So yeah, it's a big conversation. It's a big question. I think it's a very fair question to ask ourselves if we were alive in 1774 in the American colonies, like not in the outback where like there were no battles ever happened. No, but like somewhere, you know, whether it was on the ridge-ish like place or along the East Coast, like on the coast or in a big city or in a mid-sized town, I don't know. I think it's a very fair question. It's easy for modern Americans to say, oh no, I absolutely would have been on the side of liberty because we're grown up. We are
happening right now.
Oh girl, I know that. I'm not trying to get it. I'm not trying to get
I know, but
that's
I
a
mean,
different conversation.
I know, but I'm just saying it is happening right now and people are having these conversations and people are
That's true.
Having these quandaries in their head because they know what's right. They know the right thing to do, and having the courage to choose.
There is a conversation, 100%. I think it's slightly different. And you could make an argument both ways. While I absolutely see the parallels, I think it's different because
if you don't see the parallels, you're not paying attention, one. And two, we're literally going through the exact same thing right now.
It's not the exact same thing. We're not a far-flung group of colonies.
No, but I do think we are on the verge of a national revolution. I just think we are. And I think that if you don't see all of the signs for it.
Ana Luisa is a jewelry company that aims to produce pieces that tell a story. Each piece is made lovingly from the best materials. They even have a 365-day warranty. Now you can get 10% off all of their jewelry by using our code Outlander. Now we got our mom a few pieces for Mother's Day. Don't you doubt it.
They also have fair prices with jewelry starting at $39. And new jewelry is released every Friday. One of the reasons we love Ana Luisa here on the Outlander podcast is because of their commitment to sustainability and high quality craftsmanship. High quality jewelry is something that can be handed down for generations, like Jamie's mother's pearls in the story of Outlander. I'm sure you're familiar with that.
Speaking of high quality, another piece I selected was Ana Luisa's Riviera Starburst earrings with a center of moonstone. These are gorgeous earrings, and while they aren't my beloved studs, right, the really easy peasy ones, they are small enough that they don't feel heavy, and they are just the starburst, sunburst, whatever you want to call them, are just gorgeous, and they also go with everything.
When I saw their hazel earrings, I knew I had to have them. They are a stunning set of 14-karat gold-plated coin-style dangles with engraved details and zirconia accents, but the way they catch the light is just something else. And with 10% off, who doesn't want all that shimmer?
AnaLuisa.com/Outlander. Go treat yourself and your loved ones and use our code Outlander to get 10% off. We absolutely recommend them. They are a great brand making beautiful, sustainable jewelry.
So go check out AnaLuisa.com/Outlander. That's AnaLuisa.com/Outlander.
I think the parallels you're thinking of are more along the lines of what was leading up to the Civil War. I don't think it's necessarily as well paralleled just before the Revolutionary War. So I'm not saying you're wrong. There are parallels. Mm-hmm. But what I'm talking about specifically in the 18th century is that, okay, put it this way. And we're not going to mention any names. We're not going to mention any people. But if I think of someone back, and I just spent, 10 minutes talking about how I actually sympathize with a Scottish loyalist, I don't think that makes them a bad person to not want to have to lose their family again. I don't think it makes them a bad person or uneducated or unenlightened necessarily. They've been through the shiz. We just talked about this. I'm talking about specifically 18th century Highlanders who were either cleared out of Scotland in the clearances or fought around sometime in the 45, 46, and then were shipped off, right? A very specific population, Highlanders or those about. I'm not talking about anyone, just everyone existing in the colonies in the 1774. That's not what I'm saying. In this very specific population, what I'm saying is I can't fault the Scottish Highlanders who are loyalists. I can't fault Flora. I can't fault Roger, who, well, Roger's going to be a patriot, but I can't fault what Roger is saying. Like I said, he was saying the Scots had something to lose and damn little to gain. And of all people, they knew exactly what it was like to fight against the English. Those who were survived, who'd survived, weren't likely to want to live through that again. So that's a lot. That's a lot. So all I'm trying to say is I can absolutely identify with that population who did not want to go through that again. Anything like it. Whereas someone like Forbes, whether you like him or not, let's just say someone else, a patriot of that time, right, was probably anti-loyalist. They wanted the British gone. They wanted representation. Like I'm not saying it happened overnight. It took years to get to that. I understand, and I do absolutely sympathize with the patriots of the day. I think what I'm trying to get at is it's very easy from our points of view, or our time periods, our modern American views, I guess, schemata. We are groomed. We are groomed from a young age. We are educated to be pro-liberty, pro-patriotism, pro-all this stuff. Now, I'm not going to get into a discussion of whether that's good or bad. I'm just stating a fact that is in our education system. So it's very easy. It would have been easy for me, you know, 10 years ago, probably 20 years ago, to say, oh, yeah, I'm 100% on the side of the patriot. You know, 100%. I would have, you know, gone anti-loyalist. Da, da, da. All I'm trying to say is it's as you get older, at least as I, the more I read, the more I hear, the more I experience, it's a lot easier for me to identify with other populations who I may not earlier have thought I would have identified with. So I'm not saying all loyalists. No, because as you, this is not really, I don't think it's a spoiler. As you will see later on, and maybe as you've already seen, in book 7 and 8, we meet more loyalists, Americans. We meet more loyalists in Boston, in the northern colonies. And they're not always the nicest people. So I get this patriot versus loyalist or patriot versus British. Like, I get it. That's not gone. All I'm saying is I can absolutely identify with this population of Highland Scots who are loyalists. I would not want to go through it either if I were them. That's all. But more to what you're saying, I think that's slightly different than what's going on today, because today, at the time of the Civil War, there was already a, you know, for whatever, you know, good or ill, there was already an established government, and you had, you know, two like very different ways of, well, there's more. I'm vastly simplifying it and I'm bastardizing it, but it was two greatly different ways of thinking, basically. And that I could absolutely see a parallel with today. Probably more than two, but my point is I see the parallel between that more than I do with today versus
the only difference is that
patriotism.
Not only, that's really presumptuous. The only difference, in my opinion, and the way that I keep saying I think it's the same, is that the only difference is that America at that time was made up more of two groups of people, the British and then the people who didn't want to be with the British. And that's exactly the same as what we're doing now. And I know we're not trying to make this political, but I think it's the same. It's just the groups have different names, but it's exactly the same. It's exactly the same. And if we don't learn from mistakes, they happen again. So I believe we're doing it again. Feels like it.
It is the Garden of Gethsemane that she's brought to him, that she's brought him to again. Quote, I chose my way. This is Jamie speaking to Claire. Quote, I chose my way when I wed ya, though I kent it not at the time, but I chose and cannot now turn back even if I would. Unquote. So unfortunately, there's been no word of Manfred, Jamie says, and they're met by Mrs. Bug, who is in paroxysms of joy at having heard Flora's speech. She blathers on about everything she's seen and heard and then leaves to go hear Flora's husband talk. And then, now pause here. Because I'm not going to say what happens. It's not a spoiler. But Mrs. Bug.
She's asking a lot of questions, y'all.
Oh, no. I'm not even saying that. No, Mrs. Bug and probably Arch. I don't know about Arch. I'd have to ask Arch himself. But Mrs. Bug, a loyalist. I'm calling it. She's loyal to Danny. I don't know who Danny is. She's loyal to Jamie and Claire, 100%. But they have not outed themselves yet.
Right,
so
when you know the bugs, like we know the bugs.
That's what I'm saying. Didn't you think she was asking?
I know, but didn't you think it was a well-placed description of Mrs. Bug for the future story of what she would do? All of her questions. Oh, whose mausoleum is that? Oh, blah, 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 blah. I mean, I don't think it's going to be in the series because they haven't talked about the gold at all.
Oh, I didn't notice any of that. I just thought she did come over to Claire. I think they're still in front of the mausoleum. And she asks, she's in, as I said, paroxysms of joy at having heard Flora. And she blathers on about everything she's seen and heard and then leaves to go hear Flora's husband talk. So I did not write down any of the questions she asked about the mausoleum, if she did. But that was probably covered under she blathers on. So yeah, and then Jamie goes to see Jocasta. He takes Jocasta back inside because she has a headache, more specifically an eye ache. And Claire notes that there was moisture leaking out of her eye. And they get her inside and Claire examines her. She wanted to do it outside. I know. She nearly has a fit when Claire says to take her to the sitting room so we can sit you down and look at this. She's like, what the hell? No, she almost has a fit. And while she's being taken there, Claire goes, so they're going to go somewhere else. Claire goes to the sitting room to grab her her sewing basket, I guess. The room is empty, but there are scattered cups on the floor and the scent of pipe tobacco. Quote, her work basket stood open, some half-knitted garment dragged out and left to dangle carelessly down the side like a dead rabbit, unquote. And when she went to grab it and put it back into the basket, she's poked by something sharp. It was a small knife. Claire had only gone there for a needle to poke her eye. Back to Jocasta. Claire had, for a while, thought that the source of her blindness was glaucoma. And with this new pain, she knew exactly which type it was. It was the most dangerous type. So she has to pierce her sclera, I'm guessing, to relieve the pressure. She cleans the needle and pokes her eye. and then she squirts the eye with Golden Seal tea.
Please don't keep this in.
I got it now. Ulysses will
take. You can keep it in. I'm saying, please, stars, don't keep it in because I don't want to watch them mess with her eyeball.
Oh, no, we don't need to. It doesn't matter.
I'm surprised more of her surgeries aren't accompanied by the sound of vomiting, which this one is.
That's funny. No, I lost my place. Ulysses will take care of the party. It's all good, but there's no laudanum to be found. So Claire has to cast a lie in her bed and uses her rattlesnake fang syringes to irrigate her eye. Now Claire wants to leave, but Jocasta asks him to him. Exactly. Jamie wants to leave, but Jocasta asks him to stay. She asks, who else is there in the room? And he's all, it's just us, me and Claire. And she has to tell them something. She says, he was here. Who? I don't know.
Exactly.
But it was someone whose voice she recognized, and it was someone who was involved with the Frenchman's gold.
Yeah, they're not leaving that in.
Note. Now, we're potentially outside of the territory of the show because they did us a dirty. Anyway, about this thing. Her pain had begun the day before, Jocasta's. But the show must go on. So once Flora was there and the crowd was going, she goes into her sitting room to relax. And then she took some laudanum. And then she hears some voices, quote, so here you are, lass. Remember me, do you? Unquote. She'd heard the voice twice before, once at the gathering and once more than 20 years ago at an inn near Keegach, however it's pronounced, in Scotland. She heard the voices at the time. One was Dougal and one was Hector. And there was a third man in a mask. And then, quote, you ken well enough who I am, lass. Unquote. She's afraid he's come for the gold and will kill her. He said it was time for him to take the gold and return it to its rightful owner. And he stank of tobacco. So she took her wee knife out of the basket and went for his balls. And he left. So that's her telling what happened in the sitting room. At the gathering, she had said she had seen him three times before. Once tonight, once at the gathering, and once 20 years ago. At the gathering, the dude had come to her tent when she was alone. And he just stood there for a bit before saying, quote, "It's true then what they say. You're blind entirely?" Unquote. He said he was a friend of her husband's. Well, what did he want? She didn't know because he left. Back in the sitting room, the drops of blood trailed toward the door but disappeared there. So this means it hadn't been a really bad stab. It had clotted pretty quickly. Ulysses is now with Jocasta, comforting her. They get Jamie. Ulysses shows them into the butler's pantry. It's a space where one small, not even a whole block, but a small piece of the ingot was stored and slowly used. But this small piece of this chunk had been stolen. Now, of course, he has a new hiding place. The rest is safe. But he's just bringing them up to speed on, like, the sitch. And so Jamie and Claire say they'll stay a little longer, and they send the bugs back to the ridge.
Poor Mrs. Bug. She was just so excited to be not on the ridge.
I know, right?
And he sent her back first.
That night, while watching over Jocasta, Claire gets up to use the toilet, maybe, or something. But she sees Fedra. Jamie, Ian, and Ulysses had organized a system of patrol to watch over the house. So people, you know, patrolling outside at night. Fedra, though, thought she'd seen someone. And she says, quote, "Something ain't right," unquote.
And that, my friends, was the 37-page chapter that was Flora McDonald's Barbecue. Join us next time when we will be continuing our A Breath of Snow and Ashes read-along with chapter 55 entitled Wendigo, which tells me it will be Native American in nature, because that is a term that I believe is from Native American. Never mind.
I don't know where you're going.
Well, origins. I was having problems finding the words I wanted. And as always, if you'd like to join us to continue the conversation, you can head over to our group at www.outlanderpod.com/group.
And again, a very special thanks to co-producer Raquel M. To find out more about how you can support us on Patreon and maybe become a co-producer, visit outlanderpod.com/Patreon.
And if you're interested in some Outlander podcast branded items, you can go to www.outlanderpod.com/shop.
If you haven't yet joined our text community, why not? It is free. Text HELLO to 916-659-5112.
And again, thanks to our sponsor for this episode, Ana Luisa. Remember, you can get 10% off of all their jewelry when you go to analuisa.com/outlander. That's analuisa.com.
And as always, thank you so much for listening. We look forward to our next episode.
You're welcome.
Thank you to our generous partner, Zencastr, who offers high-fidelity podcasting. Check out Zencastr and use coupon code OUTLANDER20, OUTLANDER20, for 20% off 3 months or 20% off for a year. Connect with us. Visit our website at outlanderpod.com. Find us on Facebook, facebook.com/outlanderpod. We'd love for you to join our Facebook community at outlanderpod.com/group. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at outlanderpod.